Welcome to Legend Lore with Luis and Lauren, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens lines. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, and I've written for dozens of Pathfinder products. I'm also the GM for Valiant, and I write the Monstrous Physique blog here on the No Direction Network.
And I'm Lauren, and I've been playing RPGs for almost 20 years. I write the Bend the Knee blog here on No Direction, and you can also watch me play in the Adventurous and Three Ring Adventure podcasts. And this week, we're doing a special episode due to listener request. You asked for it, so we deliver. We're talking about hazards.
And before we dive into all of that, we want to mention that although we know a lot about what we're talking about when it comes to Pathfinder, we're not providing any kind of official ruling or answer. We're here to offer advice, and you can use that however you like. Remember that the official words from Paizo are the only official ruling out there. But don't forget, it's your game. Do what works best for your table.
Now, hazards are something that are both near and dear to my heart. Because I love them and because I hate them. They are so iconic. Indiana Jones running away from the boulder is just such a trope in Hollywood because it was so cool at the time. Traps are just ubiquitous in fantasy because they're so cool. But when you're a player and you roll to detect traps, and then you don't find it, and then it poisons you, and now you're dying. It's not fun. It's not always fun. So we're gonna talk today about traps. We're gonna talk about haunts. We're gonna talk about different environmental effects. And I'll just say from the get-go, I think environmental effects are purely near to my heart from love. I actually like this a lot. I think that there's a lot of great ways to run people through a quote-unquote dungeon that has no walls just by using environmental effects. You can tell an entire story about the awful wilderness that the adventurers are trapped in just by the really cool environmental effects. But Luis, this week, we're going to do this a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. In Pathfinder 1st Edition, I ran a handful of traps. In Pathfinder 2nd Edition, I have ran zero traps. Talk me through this. How are we going to do traps?
Okay, well, traps and environmental effects and haunts, all of that, they fall under the umbrella of hazards. There's a whole nice section in the core rulebook for talking about hazards and everything that you need to know about them, and includes a bunch of sample hazards. They start on page 520 in the core rulebook. Also, if you decide to make your own hazards, you can look at the Game Mastery Guide starting on page 74. It gives you all the information on how to build those. We're not going to build any hazards today. We're just going to talk about how they work in play, how players deal with them, how GMs deal with them, and exactly what they can do and how to handle all of those. So I mentioned that there are three categories of hazards. There are the typical traps, you know, things that shoot poison darts and big rolling rocks that come down after you steal a golden idol. There are environmental effects like landslides and volcanoes going off and hurricanes and tornadoes and all that stuff. And then there are haunts where there, you know, might be a spirit that has decided to murder you, or, you know, a house that is just full of malevolent energy that is throwing pots and pans everywhere. So all of those count as hazards. They all follow the same rules in terms of the basics, how to notice a trap, how to detect trap, how to disable them, how you run them in play. And then based on the needs of each individual hazard, whether it's an environmental hazard, you might have a few specific things that change depending on the type of hazard you're dealing with. So disabling a trap typically means you use thievery to try to disable that, but maybe disabling quicksand requires survival instead rather than thievery, because, you know, you need to know about nature rather than be able to pick the lock of a quicksand pit. I don't know. So they're all going to follow the same basics, and we're going to talk about the basic information here and then go into specifics about each of the three types. Hopefully that covers everything that you need to know on either side of the GM screen for you. So, Lauren, you mentioned you've dealt with traps a lot in first edition, which are just one third of the hazards in second edition. But what's really the big thing about traps is just noticing them, right?
You gotta find the trap.
You gotta find the trap. And a lot of the time you might be playing a character that is actively looking for traps, and then you find it, and then what? Then you gotta disable it, and then if things go wrong, then it activates and things like that. Pathfinder 2nd Edition follows the same basic logic for all hazards. You will first, hopefully, notice the hazard is there, and then try to disable it. If things go wrong, it might activate, or if no one notices it and you walk into its area or cause it to trigger, it will go off and stuff will go down. There are two types of hazards beyond the specific categories of the environmental trap or haunt. They are either simple hazards, which are just kind of a one and done. They go off, they're done. They might be able to reset on their own, but at that point, they're just over. You don't have to worry about initiative or anything. They just might make you do a saving throw, or they might attack you or something, and then it's over. And then there are complex hazards, which go into an initiative count. Everyone treats it like if it were combat. You enter encounter mode, do all this same stuff. You deal with your three actions per turn and everything. And the hazard itself goes through a routine that explains what it does on its turn.
So, Luis, the complex trap is sounding a lot more like your classic haunt from first edition.
Yes, actually. It's a lot more like the haunt in first edition. And I think of the two types of hazards, I prefer complex ones just because the one-and-done deal of it feels more like an annoyance more than a proper encounter. I think simple hazards are great to pepper into an encounter with monsters and the like. So you're in initiative and sometimes a simple hazard might go off, whereas a complex hazard is an encounter in and of itself. And that's more interesting to me as a GM, personally.
A quick spike trap on the wall might be an annoyance for Indiana Jones, but the rolling boulder, man, that's a whole scene.
Yeah, that's the whole scene. That rolling boulder itself is a complex hazard, and I would hazard... I would say that the other traps that he runs into as he's running away from the boulder, you know, the darts that he runs past and the spears and stuff, those are simple hazards that activate while he's in the midst of dealing with that complex hazard of the rolling boulder.
Okay, that's kind of cool, right? You got to think about this. That's kind of like a boss fight.
Yeah.
Doing it complex. Oh, man, yeah. I like it.
Complex hazards themselves, and based on the experience that they give out, are just as intricate and involved as dealing with a monster. So they can be an entire encounter. And as you said, you could probably have an entire area where all you encounter is complex hazards and have interesting encounters that deal with no monsters whatsoever. So looking at the different parts of hazards, the very first thing that comes up in the hazard stat block, which hazards have stat blocks just like monsters and items and everything, is the name, the level, and some of the traits. You know, so if you have the hidden pit hazard, it's a level 0 hazard, and it's a mechanical hazard, and it's got the trap trait. Great. All those are basics that I think you can understand. After that, though, is the stealth entry and description. The description tells you what this trap does, and the stealth entry is our first important factor in this hazard. It's how you determine how you detect a hazard. A hazard by default is naturally hidden. It's just assumed to have been hidden appropriately, so you don't notice it right away. So if you are walking into a room and there is a hazard in there, if there is a trap in there, let's say this hidden pit trap is in there, the stealth DC of the trap will tell you what the perception DC you need to meet or beat as a player to notice that the trap is there. You don't do anything else beyond that. You just will become aware of the trap.
Okay, and right here is where I want to mention that this is one of your areas where you can kind of start taking it from an annoyance into like a cool feature that's fun with the players. Mm-hmm. Even though a trap or a hazard is naturally assumed to be hidden, as a GM, you can say, you see a spike trap ahead of you. You have to deal with it to move forward. Now it's not an annoyance, it's something they can actively work towards, and that's a little bit more fun.
Yes. Yeah. Up to you if you want to reveal it. I mean, by default, it's assumed that the players have to find it. Feel free to shake that up as you like. A a hazard will list its DC, so a player that is, or a character that's looking for this will have to, you know, meet DC 18 for this hidden pit to identify that it's there, and then from then on decide what to do with that pit. But the stealth entry also notes sometimes, in parentheses after that DC, what proficiency rank in your perception you need to be able to actually even notice this. So for example, just a few traps or a few hazards down, there's the poison lock hazard, which has DC 17 and then in parentheses trained. If you are not trained in a perception, no matter how well you roll, you can't notice this. It's just beyond your capabilities. There are some that require you to be expert or master, and I think at even the highest levels there might be some that require you to be legendary. And well, if you aren't legendary, you can't notice these at all.
And one thing I want to note, players, okay, we're always wondering, like, how much do I have to dedicate into thievery to notice one of these traps? In the core rulebook, I see one trap that is master and one trap that is legendary. So for the most part, expert's going to do just what you need.
Yeah, and most character classes get you up to expert proficiency on their own, so you don't have to worry so much about it. If you want, there is a feat that gets you all the way up to master, and that should cover you most of the time. So there is a trap. There is a stealth DC. What does that mean in terms of playing it out on the table? There are two different possibilities for how this works out. If I'm going to talk about the most common one, which is you enter a room, the GM knows there's a trap there, but doesn't say anything. Unless you are actively seeking for traps or using the search exploration tactic, you aren't given a perception check at all. You have to be on the lookout for traps to be given that perception check. And then in that case, if you say, hey, I'm searching or I'm looking for traps or whatever, then the GM rolls a secret check for your perception, then determines whether or not you notice the trap. So in this case, the poison lock, we'll say the Queen of Wolves is looking around. Queen of Wolves is trained, and Queen of Wolves says, I'm going to look for traps in this room because I think the room might be trapped. The Queen of Wolves happens to be trained, rolls well enough, gets, we'll say, a 20 on the die. And look at that. Queen of Wolves detects the poison lock there. However, if she wasn't actively seeking it, she could just walk into the poison, she could just try to open that lock, and then, oops, look at that, the trap goes off. She was unaware of it.
And GMs, when your player walks into a room and says, I check for traps, okay, and if they roll well, please reveal that trap to them. Don't necessarily be like, you didn't look for tracks on that lock itself,
yeah.
Right? That's one of the things that it's kind of cool when you're a GM to be like, oh, I want them to specifically. It's kind of neat, you know, but that's also one of the biggest annoyances for a player. But I will give you this, okay, because you kind of want it to feel like special when the player specifically look at the thing they're supposed to, right? So if they walk in the room, they look for traps, sure, cool, give them their perception check. If they walk in the room, they look at the lock and say, I want to check that lock for traps. Give them a bonus to their perception.
That's a fun way to handle it, I think. so the, I was mentioning earlier, the proficiency rank comes into play. Everyone that's actively searching for a lock, you know, you can make their secret roll, or if you want, as a GM, you can ask them to roll for themselves. But once they roll, you still have to check, hey, is this person a master or expert or whatever? And if they're not, they just automatically fail. They don't detect anything, regardless of how high they roll. And then once it's been detected, great, you move on to the next step. The other way this is handled is there is some automatic detection that can go on. If the hazard doesn't list a proficiency rank, so in this case, the hidden pit just says it's DC 18, but it doesn't say trained or expert or anything like that, you just automatically, as a GM, grant the PCs their perception check. That it's so noticeable that everyone just automatically gets their chance to detect it on their own. They might still fail on their roll, but they don't have to actively tell you that they're looking for a trap or seeking around or anything if it doesn't list a proficiency in
the. And for the most part, this is going to be pits.
Yeah, it doesn't come up too often.
Not even all pits, but for the most part, pits.
Yeah, and there is, I believe, a rogue feat, Trap Finder, that also gives them free perception checks to notice traps when they come in, the free secret checks.
I think Investigator has something, too.
Yep. So, yeah, specifically Trap Finder for Rogue and Investigator. Yes, it's a feat for both of them. Even if you aren't searching, you get a check to find traps. Normally require you to be searching, but you still need to meet any other requirements, so you still need to be an expert or master or whatever. So, for the most part, the basics are come in, PCs have to tell you that they are looking for traps, then you make a secret check, and then based on proficiency and DC, determine whether or not they notice it. If you're a rogue or if it's a really easy trap, you might get a free check to do that. Moving on, the next part is probably the most important part, but not necessarily the most fun part, is disabling the trap itself. A trap will tell you its required skill, any required proficiency, and the DC to disable that trap. So, talking about this poison lock again, it requires a thievery DC 17 by someone who is trained to properly disable it. And in that case, you would use the thievery's disable a device action, which requires two actions to try to disable it. And on a success, you did it, it's disabled. If it's a complex hazard, it might require multiple successes. In that case, a single success counts as one success towards that, and a critical success counts as two successes towards that. But for the most part, you look at the hazard, then you roll the appropriate check and determine whether or not you succeed. Some hazards require you to use something like survival or religion for like haunts to disable them. The rules are unclear as to how many actions such a check would be to try to disable it. The fact that thievery's disable a device is two actions makes me feel that as a GM, I would have it that if you need religion, I would ask for two actions for that, or two actions for survival and so on, just to keep everything even and make sense with all the other rules. Again, it will list a proficiency rank if you need to be expert, if you need to be master, and so on and so forth. Some magical traps also allow you to disable them using the dispel magic spell, where you do a counteract check, and counteract is its own thing, and you follow those rules. And if you critically fail any attempt to disable it, be it a skill check or your counteract check, it activates the trap. Another way you can disable a trap, though, before we get onto the whole activation thing, some traps do list AC and hardness and things like that. You do have the option to try to just, like, damage the hazard to break it, and you would swing an attack and determine how well you hit it and how much damage you deal and stuff like that. If you reduce its hit points to its broken threshold or lower, it becomes broken and it can't be deactivated. So if you smash the spike pit or the spike trap enough, then it just won't go off.
See, the barbarian can disable traps too.
Yes. In most cases, though, if you hit the hazard, it also triggers the hazard. So you got to get pretty lucky and roll well enough to break it in one hit usually, or else it'll go off. Otherwise, it's considered an object that follows all the rules for taking damage if it were an object, so it's immune to crits and all that other stuff. Fun times. If you detect the trap and then try to disable it and then it goes off, or if you don't detect it and it goes off, it will tell you how it goes off and then all the fun stuff that the trap does. Traps have two different ways of activating. They are either via reaction or a free action. So the typical thing is a reaction. For example, the hidden pit, the reaction is if someone walks onto the trapdoor that's covering the pit, it'll use its reaction to activate itself and tell you exactly what it does. In this case, the creature falls in and they take falling damage, which is based on how far they fall, and there's a chance that they can try to catch themselves before they fall. In other cases, if like there's a spear launcher and if you step on the right pressure plate, the reaction is you step on that tile, it goes off, it makes an attack roll, and so on and so forth. Other cases might have it so it uses a free action and goes off potentially multiple times. The quicksand complex hazard, has a trigger that is a free action, which is basically just anyone walks onto where the quicksand is and it just uses a free action to start pulling someone down. So take a look at which of those actions it uses. Just like a monster, or just like a player character, hazards only can use one reaction per round. So you can't have someone step on a pressure plate, activate it, and then the next person step on a pressure plate and activate it again. It's been activated. The reaction has gone off.
Now, some of these even also have an action. This is something we're going to talk about more when we get to complex hazards. For example, the spinning blade pillar uses an action to do a spinning blade. So when we get to that, we're going to have to talk about how many actions a trap gets in its turn.
Yes. So once the trap has gone off, it might be over. That might be it. If it is a simple hazard, it will tell you what it does, and it might list a reset option or reset listing there. That'll tell you that, you know, the trap might reset automatically after like 10 minutes if you leave it alone, or it might tell you that you can reset it if you take the time to cover up the trap door again over the hidden pit or stuff like that. If it doesn't have a reset hazard, it's just one and done, and it's over. It's done. But as Lauren mentioned, complex hazards have a lot more going on with them. Rather than just have them go off, they, when they trigger, they will tell you what they do, and then most likely tell you that they roll initiative. Most traps use stealth for initiative. In cases where they don't use stealth, it'll tell you, but they roll their initiative, they get put onto the initiative count as normal, and everyone takes their turns dealing with the trap. The trap itself will then list a routine and tell you what it does on its turn. The quicksand hazard, for example, will use one action on its turn. That's all it does. Just uses this one action to pull down every creature that's in the quicksand. But the spinning blade pillar uses three actions, and each of those makes a spinning blade strike against an adjacent creature, and then it moves the pillars in a random direction, and finally it makes another spinning blade attack. So it just kind of spins all over the place, and it uses the full three actions on its round. If it only lists one action, it only gets the one action. You don't use one action and then one action and then one action. It tells you how many actions you use on that, and in some cases it might have more than three actions, like the drowning pit has four actions.
So a complex hazard is really just going to be like a simple hazard that does something every turn until it has stopped.
Yeah. You can run it just like a monster in that it, when its initiative count comes up, you kind of do what it says, but it follows this routine every time, and you will have to deal with that routine every round. And while this is all going on, player characters still have their chance to disable the hazard and might need to disable the hazard before it's done with its routine. Some traps keep going on until they are disabled. So this spinning blade pillar, for example, you can attempt to disable it by doing thievery checks on each of the pillars, and you would need to do that mid-combat. You'd have to catch up to one of the pillars, do a thievery check, and manage to get two successes per pillar to eventually shut it all down. And the quicksand trap just requires you to use survival to kind of pull yourself up and stuff like that. So everything varies from hazard to hazard, but the basics are that check for stealth and whether or not anyone detects it, then anyone can attempt to disable it if it's been detected, or it'll activate and then do its thing or go into its routine, and there might be further disable checks after that.
On the surface, it seems complicated, but it's really just like a fancy monster that doesn't get a choice. It does what it do.
Yeah, a fancy monster that tells you exactly what it does, and it has no tactics, it has no logic other than the specific logic that's been programmed in. So all of those hazards follow the same techniques, all the same stats, all the same information. But there is, I think, some consideration with each of the different types of hazards. Traps, I think, are the easiest. Most people understand what traps are, and the game's history has traps built into it so much that I think most people just kind of understand traps pretty easily. Environmental hazards are a little bit strange because you have environmental hazards that just trigger when someone, like, I don't know, walks under a tree and a bunch of snow falls onto them and stuff like that. They are pretty simple, I think. I think the one that people have hardest time figuring out, though, are haunts. Because haunts are a little different. They don't have the very obvious, like, oh, I can just pick this part of the trap and disable it with my thieves' tools. Great, easy enough. Or something like an environmental hazard. You might just say, oh, I use survival to notice it and walk around it or something like that. Haunts are interesting because they tend to have a lot of narrative built into them mechanically and have a lot of other considerations. A haunt typically doesn't use thievery to disable them. It uses strange things like maybe
religion. Occultism.
Yeah, occultism. The level 10 hazard in the core rulebook, the bloodthirsty urge, an object haunted by the echoes of a vicious mind, attempts to kill someone who comes near it, is a haunt. And to disable that, you use religion to exorcise a spirit or diplomacy to try to talk the spirit down. And I think it's hard for people to understand, what do I do with it? I would say, as a GM, I recommend being very transparent, not just with haunts, but with all hazards, about what skills you can use to disable it and just how that looks in play. So if you need to talk down this bloodthirsty urge haunt, you can explain that, you know, there might be a spirit that manifests or like a ghostly image that manifests. So now you have something that your characters can look at and know, oh, I'm going to direct my diplomacy check or my religion check towards this spirit, rather than just say, oh, the candelabra lifts up invisibly and like tries to bonk you on the head.
And this is another situation where I feel like, as a GM, you could put some wiggle room in here, and it might really help your players, right? Even if the stat block says use religion or diplomacy to defeat this hazard, instead you can just be like, what you got, players? What you got? What's your idea? And just let that work if it's a good idea.
Yeah, if the haunt is born because of a noble family that got murdered, maybe using lore about that family will help you talk them down or something like that.
Yeah. Award creativity. That's not rule zero in the game, but it should be.
0.1.
Yeah.
Or 0A and 0B.
Or rule negative one.
So haunts, otherwise when they trigger, they kind of follow the same rules. They might have specific traits that you have to worry about, like the mental trait or fear trait and stuff like that, that has a little bit more baggage with what
players, or the
death trait with what characters can do. But for the most part, it's kind of the same thing. I recommend giving every hazard kind of a space, if you're using a battle grid, a space where they exist, so people can direct things towards that. So you can direct your religion checks towards that, or be adjacent to it to do your disable checks with thievery and stuff like that. Just because I think giving something a place and giving something kind of a physical feature makes it a lot easier to understand and to kind of work with for a lot of players, even if it's just you describing that, oh, the spirit seems to be bound to the fireplace, so it's throwing stuff from the fireplace or something like that.
And especially for some of the traps that you think your players are going to really have a hard time dealing with, there is a really good argument to be made for not making it in stealth at all. Just telling them that it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's hazards. There's a lot of hazards out there. They will vary wildly depending on what you need them to do or what the story needs them to do at the time. So I'd say look through the hazard rules in the core rulebook just to get a refresher. But honestly, reading through the stat blocks and maybe even playing with one or two hazards, once you played with them, it's a lot easier to understand what to do with them. I recently ran my players through the beginner box and Troubles in Otari, the whole kind of beginner package thing, and there is a point where there is an environmental hazard made by magic, and I think after having run that, I feel much better about hazards than I did beforehand, just because having that experience of having run them a few times makes it make sense a lot more. Every hazard as well will tell you in the description that, you know, maybe there are three panels in the wall that fire darts at people, and each of those panels has you disable each of those panels individually. So keep in mind what the description says so you can better understand where the disable checks go into and things like that. The spinning blade pillar, for example, it's just a single pillar, but it moves around, so you will have to keep track of where it is on the battlefield so then the characters can reach it and then attempt to disable it. It constantly moves around, so knowing where that is important. Knowing where the panels are for a trap, knowing where the haunt has manifested, knowing where the environmental hazard is or is going to be if it's not deactivated is an important thing. A sense of place really helps a lot with hazards. There's another thing that is hazard adjacent, which are snares in this game. They are a special type of item that player characters can use. Effectively, you create your own hazard. So you can do things like a little biting snare, which is like a bear trap that you place down and stuff like that.
This is how you give the GM a taste of their own medicine.
Yes. They are a little different than your typical hazard because they use the DCs and stuff that are based on the character. So if a character created the hazard, or created the snare, excuse me, it uses their crafting DC to determine the difficulty to disable them. It also uses your crafting DC to determine the stealth DC for stuff like that. But for the most part, you handle them like you would a simple hazard. I mean, all the DCs and damage and triggers and stuff like that are kind of built into the snare stat block itself. It'll tell you that, you know, it triggers when someone walks into the space with the biting snare, for example. But you can run it just like you would any simple hazard. So keep an eye out for those.
I love the level 20 snare. Instant evisceration snare.
Yep.
It's like, oops, I snagged my foot. Instant evisceration.
Yep. So when you're running snares, or including snares in your game, just know that you can follow the same tactics. If a kobold trapper has put a snare down, for the most part, you can use the same basic rules that you use with hazards. Detect it first, and then you can attempt to disable it, or it might get triggered, and it does its thing. And for the most part, they are always simple hazards rather than complex hazards.
Now, I would hazard a guess that some folks have had some questions about hazards. User JTrain1 asks, what do you think about no-win traps hazards? For example, the Grimtooth book series.
Grimtooth hazards, I think, I don't know how long this has been around. I remember finding them back in my 3-5 days. There's just hundreds and hundreds of hazards, and I think hazards that are just mean for the sake of being no wins or means are not worth it. I mean, that's adversarial GMing. I don't recommend doing that kind of stuff. Unless your players ask for it. Like, if they specifically request it, not like, they deserve it. But if they, like, want to go into, you know, the Tomb of Horrors, they just know that they're going to be getting that kind of stuff, then yeah, feel free to go for it. But I think you should always have some way out or some way to disable or defeat a hazard, even if it's ridiculous and like out of the way or convoluted. But never just you can't win and you have to deal with it, because at that point, I mean, you might as well just do the typical rocks fall and everyone dies. Like, it's the same mentality.
I'm not really familiar with Grimtooth traps, to be perfectly honest. Please don't judge me. But I do kind of agree that if you're just there to be mean and they can't win, that's not really the best idea. Unless there's like a really cool like story reason for it. And the players know this going into it. I think a lot of this is just about giving the players more knowledge to have a good time with it. A lot of the problems with traps is that players don't know what to expect, and then they're slammed in the face. They're almost like punished for something they couldn't have known about. They're going to have a better time if you just tell them as much about it as possible.
Now, a lot of the Grimtooth traps as well were, like, really goofy. And I'm all for goofy traps. If it's goofy and, like, memorable, like, hey, you go to open the chest, and when you open it up, it, like, activates a springboard under your feet and launches you, like, 40 feet away into a pit trap or something. That's goofy and funny, and I think not necessarily a no-win situation. A memorable trap is more interesting than just one that hurts and is, you know, here for the sake of just ruining everyone's day. You know, something goofy or something interesting. I'd still say go with that if you can. All right. This question is from user Ace Wizard, who asks, how do you wean your players off of constantly looking for traps?
Man, this is a good question. Let me preface by saying this is PTSD. Players constantly look for traps because they haven't had fun with them, and they don't want to not have fun with them again. It's not about them trying to ruin the game. So the way you get your players to stop doing that is to make them fun. And this is why I said earlier, maybe you just tell your players, like, you know, you're in a hallway and there's a tons of panels, and some of the panels on the floor are red. Now your players are going to look for traps intentionally here, which I get it. That's not what you're asking. But the thing is, if your players can learn to expect that from you, if they can expect that you will give them a clue that there might be a trap around, now they're not going to do it obsessively over every single little thing. Another thing to keep in mind, though, is that because this is the nature of the game, and because it's been around for so long, they might check for traps every time on the treasure chest at the end of the dungeon. It's just something we know to expect, and you might not be able to get them to stop doing that. But again, I like the idea, give them clues that it's there. Let them learn to teach them when you want them to check for traps. I think that's going to get you the results you want.
Another thing you can do mechanically is take advantage of secret checks. If you want, you can just give everyone the effects of the trap finder feat and let everyone automatically roll secret checks to maybe notice if there's a trap around. If you do have a rogue or an investigator with trap finder feat, maybe bump up their bonus to their checks on traps to make up for the fact that, you know, they took the feat, and then everyone else also has the feat. But I think if you remember 4th edition D&D and 5e D&D, they have a little thing called passive perception, which is just your perception bonus plus 10. A passive perception bonus kind of thing would be pretty useful for this. You know, people who are very good at perception might notice stuff automatically, and if they want, if they're concerned about traps, then they can actively choose to roll and possibly get better than a 10 plus their bonus. But in this case, you know, it gives them that kind of peace of mind where it's like, well, we know the dinky little traps we're going to always kind of be aware of, and, you know, the GM will just tell us, or the GM will roll for us in secret and stuff like that. So maybe implementing something like that would also help out by just, you know, guaranteeing that by default there's always going to be some kind of check or some kind of roll, and I'll let you know when stuff comes up. But you're always free to take back control and choose to actively look for stuff when you feel the time is right.
And I do think that this is another situation where, by the way, Luis, I love this idea. I think this is a great way to handle it. I do think this is another situation where, though, if you know that there's a poison lock in the room and they specifically say, we know that we have, you know, passive trap finding, but I want to search that lock, maybe even give them another roll. You know, they already had their secret roll from you. Maybe give them another roll and maybe even give them like a plus one on it. From patron Lytus, complex hazards and haunts can be very intimidating and impressive, but they vanish with a single skill check, which deflates the experience. How do you balance that? If you require more successes, I mean, how would you balance that?
Well, I think most complex hazards, if you look at the ones in the core rulebook, already have multiple successes required for that. So if you're just grabbing stuff out of the core rulebook, you're most likely already dealing with multiple successes there. I think you can just add one or two extra successes required. So, for example, there's a summoning rune that's a complex hazard, and first you have to use acrobatics to kind of sneak up on the rune before you can use thievery to disable it. So just adding a thing like that, like, you know, acrobatics to balance across so you don't actively activate it or something like that, or using athletics to lift up like a heavy gate to get at the mechanisms inside or something. Just something else that is a second check or a third check that isn't just I need two successes on thievery rather than just one, giving both a different skill that's required and giving other people a chance to play with the hazards is really good. But the other thing you can do is just make it so everyone has to do their own specific check to get out of the hazard or deal with the hazard. The quicksand hazard is a good example of this, that the disable check, I think, should really apply to everyone that's stuck in the quicksand. Everyone makes their survival to try to get out and stuff like that, or later athletics to swim out. So it's technically only one check, one success is required, but because in theory everyone in the party is doing it, that is again multiple successes that are required to do that. And in terms of balancing it, just follow the hazard creation rules. They're balanced in terms of damage and stuff like that. If you want to make a very complicated hazard that uses a lot of successes and stuff like that, I'd say find the level that you're looking for your hazard, and then lower that by one level to make up for all the extra successes that you're needing and stuff like that.
One thing I might add, if you're really worried about balance, the point of balance is just to make sure that everybody's having a good time, right? If you're going to add successes, just make sure you add things that the players are good at. And I think that'd be a good way to handle it.
The other way you can make a complex hazard, I just thought of, and I really all hazards more interesting, is just add more stuff to have going on in the encounter at the time. So we mentioned that rolling boulder trap for Indiana Jones, adding the extra little simple hazards of the jumping the pit and you know the spears that get launched at him. That's an extra layer of interesting stuff. Add a monster or two that's going on, that's going to be fighting you while the complex hazard is going stuff. Even if you only need one success, it suddenly becomes a lot more pressure, a lot more interesting, because there's a bunch of more stuff for the players to have to worry about.
And the best part about that is that balance is already baked into the game. The hazards have levels, the creatures has levels, and the game tells you how to add up that encounter difficulty and award XP.
Yep, exactly. Our next question here is from patron Jaina B, who asks, most pit traps have a disable description that involves removing the trapdoor. This still leaves a pit for the players to cross. Could the trapdoor instead be jammed shut instead to make it so you can cross it safely?
Well, you know, you're asking about a pit trap, but I think this whole concept could apply to lots of other kinds of traps. Can the players do a thing that makes it disable the way they want it to disable? I mean, what about the spinning blade pillar? What if they wanted to trap or to disable it in a specific spot so they could climb it later, right? I don't see any reason you couldn't just increase the DC to disable it just a tiny bit to get it to go the way they want it to go.
Yeah, I think maybe not even raising the DC. You can just say, how do you disable this? You know, if it's disabled, it's disabled. It just, you can choose to disable it by jamming the door. You can choose to leaving it open. You can have the spear trap disabled by just removing all the spears or by locking them up so they can't be fired or anymore. You can disable it in such a way that I think makes most sense for what you want your character to have happen, what you need the story to be. I know that the thievery skill itself says when you disable a device, if you get a critical success, you can also rearm it later. So, you know, in theory, if you do well enough, you might leave it armed. So if someone's following you, it triggers when they show up instead, but it lets your party get past without any problem. So I don't see any reason why you shouldn't be able to leave that jammed rather than leave the big pit open instead.
From patron Dom, is it okay for players to overcome hazards without a roll if they come up with some ingenious plan?
Yes, absolutely. If there's a pit trap and someone uses a bunch of castings of create water to fill it with water, and then you just swim across instead, great, you did that. You've beaten the trap. I don't care if you didn't roll the things that the stat blocks say. The stat block is there to give you like the basics, like here's what we think should happen, but the stat blocks can't account for every possibility at all in the game. If you send a summoned creature down the hall to activate all the traps, then the summoned creature gets absolutely obliterated, but now the traps are disabled because they've been used up. Great, you've beaten the trap as well. Great, you did it. I don't think you should feel restricted by what's in the stat block.
I want to answer this question a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I want to answer a bigger question here. Is it okay for blank? Okay, I want to tell you yes. It is okay for blank.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's not stepping on the toes or making the game less fun for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you do in this role-playing game, ever, if it's not making the game less fun for another player, it is okay to allow it.
Yeah. Obviously, within reason, if someone says, hey, I want to, you know, get superpowers and be able to shoot lightning bolts out of my eyes or whatever, whatever makes sense for what's going on.
But hey, if that doesn't make the game less fun for anybody else, why not, right? Especially if you work with them and give them reasons to do it.
That's
sure.
True.
Let's go on a quest and make this happen. And if everybody's on board, like, this is awesome. We all want to do this. Now you have an adventure. It was 100% allowed to do that.
That's true. If you build up to it and if you work it into your story and what's going on, absolutely. But don't ever feel like the stat block is the end all be all of how something is handled in the game, or the feats, or anything else that's really written into the rules. Unless you're in Pathfinder Society, which is a bit stricter, but even then, they reward creative solutions. So someone filling the trap with a bunch of water would probably still succeed and be able to move on.
I'll go on record saying the only rules that matter in even society play is that the paperwork gets filled out correctly.
Yeah.
Nothing else matters. If you make up rules on the spot in PFS and everybody's having a great time and then you audit it correctly, who cares? Everyone had fun, and that's what they showed up for, was fun. I hope you've been trapped by an engaging conversation, because that's all we have for you today. Make sure you check out the rest of our content on the No Direction Network. If you like this show or any of our other blogs or shows, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/nodirection, because it's the support of our patrons that makes this all possible.
Until next time, I'm Luis.
And I'm Lauren.
Thanks for listening to Legend Lore, and as always, it's been legendary.